Over the years, I have wondered about a statement that is found in the book of Revelation. So I'd like you to turn with me, please, to Revelation chapter 13 and beginning halfway through verse 4, where we find the following words. Chapter 13, verse 4, as I say, halfway through. And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? My problem was, why would the people worship the beast? I can picture the beasts of Daniel and Revelation as they stood upon the shores of the sea. I also remember the graphic images that were on the feast films during the time of Mr. Armstrong's ministry. But then 10 kings gave their power to the beast. I found myself wondering, just what is this beast? I had to answer that question to understand why the people would worship the beast. I found it all rather puzzling. So today I would like to examine just exactly what this beast is, because in so doing we'll be able to clarify just why it is being worshipped. Over the past few weeks, both Mr. Bowles and Mr. Henderson have been referring to the situation that we find ourselves in today. In the modern world, we seem to be drifting into an age where the God of creation is being marginalised. By the educational system, the hypothesis of evolution is being promoted as fact by educators from primary schools to the forums of higher education. Something strange is going on, sometimes behind the scenes and sometimes almost in plain view. Care is now being delivered to the needy from the cradle to the grave. That care is not being offered by the accepted institutions that normally have been associated with charity and caring. The family and charitable institutions are nowhere to be seen. It is now charity being administered, care being administered by the state. And it is there and now intruding into almost every sphere of life. Over the course of the last century, a system of welfare has been introduced into a number of countries. And this probably began in Germany of Bismarck, the late 19th century, with a type of social contract that now permeates all social thinking. It is the state will take care of you approach, an approach that demands an almost religious acceptance of the dictates that emanate from government, departments of all sorts. Indeed, Benito Mussolini, the socialist dictator of Italy prior to and during the Second World War, did his utmost with a large degree of success to replace the Italian state religion, that was Roman Catholicism, with a religion of the state. Adolf Hitler did the same, and the Nuremberg rallies were treated almost as if they were near religious experiences. Indeed, I would venture to say that they were religious experiences for those who actually took part. The state is set centre stage, and all must submit to it. We see this in Britain, and now also we're beginning to see it in the United States. I'd like to read a short passage from Jonah Goldberg's book, Liberal Fascism, from page 23, and I'd have to read this. Liberal fascism is the title of the book. Fascism is a religion of the state. It assumes the organic unity of the body politic and longs for a national leader attuned to the will of the people. It is totalitarian in that it views everything as political and holds that any action by the state is justified to achieve the common good. It takes responsibility for all aspects of life, including our health and well-being, and seeks to impose uniformity of thought and action, whether by force or through regulation and social pressure. Everything, including the economy and religion, must be aligned to those objectives. Any rival identity is part of the problem and therefore defined as the enemy. According to Mr. Goldberg's definition of fascism, it is a religion of the state, the body politic. And this brings us onto the words written by Christopher Booker and Richard North. On page 590 of The Great Deception, which was a book about the European Union that was written by Messrs. Booker and North, we read the following under the subheading, The Pro-European Orthodoxy. One of the hardest things for future historians to reconstruct about British attitudes towards Europe in the late 1980s and early 1990s will be the peculiar psychological pressure which had by now built up to make the benefits of Britain's membership of the community an article of faith which no rational reason could question. In the worlds of politics, the media and big business, acceptance of Europe had become an unchallenged orthodoxy. In this respect, British supporters of Europe caught something of that quasi-religious faith in the project which had long been shown by its devotees on the continent. They were believers in a way reminiscent of those who accept any collective religious ideology, taking for granted that it possessed an inherent moral superiority which brooked no questioning. The symbolism of Europe centred on the altruistic ideas of selfless cooperation, peace, ever closer union, in itself carried religious overtones. It was this which underpinned that all-embracing sense of rightness which for many years seemed to carry all before it. As it said, they were believers in a way reminiscent of those who accept any collective religious ideology, taking for granted that it possessed an inherent moral superiority which brooked no questioning. Yet, was it all done openly and above board? When Britain entered the common market, no one was told that it would be a political union, that it was to be the creation of a federal state. Had this been stated at the time, the British people would have rejected the European Economic Community as it was then, the European Union as it is now. The same could be said for the Catholic Church. There is a mix of truth and error, a great deal of error. A claim that the Apostle Peter was the first Pope, when in fact there is no biblical reference to Peter ever having been in Rome during the time of the first century. Indeed, the Apostle Paul closes his epistle to the Romans and he greets over 20 members of the church in Rome personally. But there's no mention of Peter. And the reason must be quite simple. Peter was nowhere near Rome. He just was not there at that time. With those two quotations given a minute or so ago, a third comes to mind. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worship the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? On page 9 of the booklet, Who is the Beast? Mr. Armstrong wrote the following. They worship the beast, Revelation 13:4. Therefore, some conclude from this one statement alone that the beast must be the papacy, not knowing that the people worship the Roman Empire and its emperors. Notice how they worship the beast, saying, Who is able to make war with him? The Roman Empire was the greatest war-making power the world had ever known. But the Catholic Church never had an army. The beast killed with the sword, that is in verse 10 of chapter 13. But the Catholic Church never did. History is full of accounts of the worship of the Roman emperors, for paganism was a state religion. Still quoting from Mr. Armstrong, the following is from Robinson's Medieval and Modern Times, an older college textbook from page 7. The worship of the emperor. In a word, the Roman government was not only wonderfully organized, everyone was required to join in the worship of the emperor because he stood for the majesty and glory of the dominion. And all were obliged as good citizens to join in the official sacrifices to the head of state as a god. As has been seen from history, and in more recent times, emperors have been revered as gods, from the Caesars of ancient Rome to Lenin and Stalin to Adolf Hitler to Benito Mussolini, Chairman Mao, and a multitude of others. These have all headed bestial regimes which have killed by the sword. They were treated as gods at the head of their relative bureaucracies. And it was to the men of these lesser bureaucracies that the mortals, the common man, looked. The emperor was worshipped, but he was only the representative of the state. In reality, it was the state that was being worshipped, the government officers and the departments of those governments that held that religious acceptance of the dictates of those departments and those government officers was or is the answer to all the problems of mankind. The worship of the beast is not some airy-fairy idea of prophets and apostles of long ago. As is shown by Mr. Armstrong, Jonah Goldberg, Mrs. Booker and North, and others, it is an emerging facet of the world in which we live today. In closing, I'd like to turn back to Revelation where we began, Revelation chapter 13 and verse 4, and read as follows. And they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, Who is like unto the beast? That is, who is like this state, this entity? Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? It is the state which is being worshipped, not some airy-fairy idea. It is a definite political entity which is being worshipped as very God in the eyes of so many, many people.